Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, honoring the Community Water Center's leaders as recipients of the 2018 James Irvine Foundation's Leadership Awards, on the web at irvine.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need, on the web at chcf.org. And the California Endowment, health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we'll find out how scientists are turning to computer game users to solve a big problem for Valley pistachio growers. We'll also talk with Amanda Renteria, a Valley girl who went on to big things with the Hillary Clinton campaign. Now she's running for governor. Does she actually stand a chance, given the late start to her campaign? We'll find out where she stands on some important issues. And we'll learn about the invasive swamp rodent that is causing big headaches for Valley farmers, wildlife officials, and others. It's called the nutria, and some people warn that if it's not controlled soon, it could be a huge issue in just a few years. Plus, a look at the competing accusations about impropriety with members of the Kern County Board of Supervisors over the issue of marijuana dispensaries. We begin, though, with the issue of transportation. Fresno is California's largest city without a light rail system. With the city's sprawling nature and ample parking lots, efforts to bring rapid transit to the area have never taken off. One other reason, light rail is also really expensive. Now Fresno officials hope to bring some of the elements of those commuter trains to the city's bus system at a much more affordable price tag. It's a concept around the world that's called bus rapid transit, or light rail on wheels. FM 89's Laura Tsutsui reports on the latest addition to Fresno Area Express service by talking to the people who use it.
For months, Danita Ashley has taken the bus to attend classes at UEI College. By now, she's used to the commute.
It's one way. And this bus is pretty fast, like every 15 minutes, so it's pretty fast.
The old route included a stop near her house and took Ashley straight to Manchester Mall. But last week, her commute changed. Earlier this month, the city of Fresno updated their busiest routes along Blackstone and Kings Canyon Avenues. The new route is served by the bus rapid transit system that they're calling FACTS-Q.
Q stands for quick and quality.
Jim Shad is Fresno's director of transportation. He says that the nearly $50 million project is an effort to provide better service for the city's riders and maybe even attract new ones.
Yeah, what we've seen when we've provided faster service with more frequencies is our ridership actually goes up. My primary goal is to see our ridership increase.
Fresno's bus service had over 9 million riders last year, but that number is in decline from previous years. By implementing BRT along the most popular routes, the hope is that riders keep coming back. In some ways, the new ride is an improvement. During FACTS-Q's first week of service, I wanted to find out what it was like for myself, so I rode the bus. Going from Courthouse Park in downtown Fresno to Woodward Park in North Fresno took almost 15 minutes less on FACTS-Q than the regular bus. The bright blue buses that serve FACTS-Q are easily spotted, as are the new shelters at every stop. Each shelter is a large metal structure along the sidewalk with a glass roof. Most contain a bench or two, and a digital sign hanging from the roof has real-time bus tracking information. Unlike the old Blackstone route, there are fewer stops in total, and they're spaced every half mile. FACTS-Q doesn't stop as often, so the commute time is less. On top of that, BRT buses have priority at traffic signals, which also reduces travel time. And fare kiosks at each new shelter means riders pay before boarding. All they need to do is hold on to their ticket. All of these features make FACTS-Q more like a light rail service than a regular bus. Light rail is a faster form of public transportation, but it can be expensive to build. Creating this middle ground of bus rapid transit in Fresno is something Shad has been looking forward to.
I feel like a proud parent at graduation.
Daniel Rodriguez is a professor at UC Berkeley and associate director of the school's Institute for Transportation Studies. Rodriguez says that middle ground of better service and affordable upgrades often makes BRT an improvement for cities.
Ultimately, I think for downtowns, for busy corridors, this is the wave of the future.
But Rodriguez also says BRT is not a quick fix for making public transportation popular.
I would be surprised if there is a dramatic jump in ridership. In fact, what you're seeing pretty much across the board in the U.S. is that transit ridership is going down. And so this is one way of stopping that bleeding of riders.
James Sinclair writes a blog about Fresno's transportation and city planning. He says that while the effort is good, the city still has some details it has to work out.
So my biggest criticism has been that this bus service launched on Monday, and at the same day, they discontinued Route 30, they modified Route 28, and they modified Route 26, but none of that information had been provided to the public. So it took until Tuesday of this week for the website to be updated with that kind of information.
The city did use social media and a dedicated blog to advertise new FaxQ service and changes to routes. They also held town halls to solicit community feedback. But Sinclair says that the outreach could have been better.
So the easiest thing they could do, and it would not cost a lot of money, is do a better job at sort of providing information to people. FaxQ knows where the customers are. They're on the bus.
During its first week, FaxQ offered free rides and had ambassadors at every shelter to help people get accustomed to the service. Joe Garrison has been riding the bus since Fresno City College offered students free rides. He sees a difference in FaxQ.
It does seem to be like more expedient. Like, I seem like I'm getting to school a little bit faster and getting home a little bit faster than I was before.
But not every rider agrees. Danita Ashley doesn't like Fresno's BRT. Since FaxQ doesn't use the stop near her house, she has to catch a bus that runs less frequently to get to FaxQ and transfer. Depending on her first bus, it could take her an extra 20 minutes to get to school. But Ashley is hoping she won't be taking the bus much longer anyways.
I'm actually finna buy me a car, so it ain't gonna be too long I'll be have to catch the bus no more.
With Valley Public Radio, I'm Laura Satsui.
You're listening to Valley Edition. It wasn't long after the invention of the internet that scientists discovered the potential for using computing power as a citizen science tool. One of the earliest examples was a computer program developed in the 1990s that allowed users to search for life on other planets. Now a new collaboration takes aim at something a little closer to home. FM89's Carrie Klein brings us this story about an intersection between citizen science, health, and agriculture that has implications right here in the San Joaquin Valley.
It's 1 p.m. on a Friday, and Patrick Camarador is getting ready to live stream a video game. The UC Davis senior puts down his textbooks, puts on a headset, and clicks on music. Some days, he plays games like Legend of Zelda or Splatoon, but today, he's put on safety glasses and a lab coat. It's a kind of inside joke with his streaming audience.
My name is Socrates, also known as Patrick, and welcome back to Sox Lab.
The game is called Fold It, and it transforms hundreds of thousands of players like Camarador into citizen scientists. Rather than collecting treasure or destroying bad guys, the goal is to tweak the structures of proteins to solve real-world biological problems.
Oh, round four. Ooh, actually, we'll go round two.
Players get a molecular model of a protein and have to fold, twist, and rotate it into new configurations. They get points for efficiency. The game offers hundreds of molecular challenges.
Fold It is what I would describe as a protein folding sandbox puzzle game.
One of the newest puzzles involves aflatoxin, a family of carcinogens that contaminate crops around the globe and lead to serious health problems. In Fold It's aflatoxin challenge, players try to fold a protein into a shape that'll break down the aflatoxin molecule into something harmless. Camarador didn't know much about aflatoxin beforehand, but he's learned about it by playing. And the mission speaks to him.
This could have very real effects on the food supply, the economy, food supplies overseas. And there's just a lot of context behind it that makes it too important to ignore.
Aflatoxin is the most potent natural carcinogen known. It's caused by a fungus that can grow in crops like pistachios, peanuts, and cotton. A single outbreak in corn in Kenya killed 125 people in 2004, while long-term exposure is responsible for tens of thousands of liver cancer diagnoses each year. That's why Themis Michelides is grinding up pistachios to test for aflatoxin. He studied plant diseases for almost 30 years for the University of California Research Extension in Parlier.
My emphasis is how we can manage this, how we can reduce it, so these crops are not, they're free from aflatoxin.
He says a lot has been done to control aflatoxin. Rigorous regulations prevent the compound from being a major health problem in the U.S. and Europe, but prevention is expensive and still not 100% effective, despite a new biopesticide Michelides helped bring to the valley. And the problem is far worse abroad. That's why more solutions are needed and why researchers are excited about an unorthodox strategy like Foldit. If experts like Michelides are struggling to find a solution, crowdsourcing it may seem like a surprising move. But it makes sense to Justin Siegel. He's a biochemist at UC Davis and one of the minds behind the aflatoxin challenge. Proteins are giant molecules made mostly of carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen, and when their structures change, so do their functions. Siegel says the protein players use in the game is so big, there are far more possible structures than any individual could find.
The number of potential conformations is bigger than the number of stars in the universe. It's a ridiculous number. So it's really a very, very difficult problem.
Foldit has a history of crowdsourcing difficult problems. In 2012, players redesigned a protein to speed up chemical reactions, and players have been listed as authors on a handful of scientific papers. Since October, Siegel says players have already submitted nearly 500,000 possible solutions to the aflatoxin challenge. Siegel plans to test a few thousand of those in his lab to find one that destroys aflatoxin. The ultimate goal is to then create some way of delivering it to the fields.
You can imagine a spray that goes over the crop, or you can imagine it, other mechanisms to help maybe wash away and get rid of aflatoxin, and take highly concentrated bits of aflatoxin and use these catalysts to help destroy it.
So could the Foldit strategy actually work? Bob Klein says maybe. He's manager of the California Pistachio Research Board, and he estimates California's pistachio industry alone spends millions on aflatoxin testing and lost product. He says Foldit's basic premise sounds promising, but...
How to get the enzyme to the place where the aflatoxin is in the contaminated nut or contaminated product becomes a big challenge.
You know, these are little side chains on this sort of backbone here, right?
That final product will be important, but aflatoxin researchers could never even get there without people like Patrick Camarador putting on lab coats and playing a game between classes. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Residents in the San Joaquin Valley already know the name Amanda Renteria. Now the rest of the state is about to get acquainted with the Woodlake native and former national political director for the Clinton campaign in 2016. Last week, she formally launched her campaign for California governor in a move that puzzled many political observers. After all, the June primary is just a few months away, and Renteria needs to build an organization, raise funds, and more importantly, get name recognition statewide in a very short time frame. Amanda Renteria joins us now to talk about those and other things. Amanda, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for everyone who's listening in my home valley. It's great to be on air.
Amanda, the last time we spoke, it was back in 2014, and you were running for Congress to unseat David Valadao. That bid was ultimately unsuccessful. Why do you think you can win this time in a field against candidates that already have a head start?
Well, I think we're in an entirely different year. And as you can see around the state, really around the country, you have a different kind of political engagement today. And I think what you're seeing is people really do want to have political leaders who are sincerely a part of public service, who have been there for a really long time. I also just believe that we are in an incredibly important moment right now where we need leaders who are really paying attention to all parts of our state. And of course, being from the Central Valley, I don't believe that this is just a drive-through area. This is my home. This is where I'm from. And when you think about the challenges that are facing California, you know, the Central Valley has a unique perspective on this, whether we're talking about education or clean air and clean water or different industries that we have in the Central Valley. You know, that perspective deserves a voice. And frankly, I believe that all Californians, it's not only important for them to hear it, but I believe they're ready to hear from different perspectives today.
Running for governor is something that usually people take some time to deliberate over. Was it a long process for you? Walk us through how you came to make this decision to leave the Attorney General's office.
Sure. So I do want to say that leaving the California Department of Justice as a chief of operations was, I had to really think through that. And because I loved the work that we did there in terms of public safety and everything that we've been doing, fighting on the front lines in terms of protecting California people and California values. But as I began to look at this governor's race, it's been brewing over time as I think about the leadership of our state. And it particularly hit me in that last week of January when I attended the Women's March, when I saw protesters and young people speaking out, dreamers speaking out in front of UCLA's campus. And then I walked into the gubernatorial debate. And I sat there in the audience with many young folks, college students, and we're looking at the stage, and it happens to be two front runners who are arguing over who used their political power more to enrich themselves. And it was one of those moments when you're sitting there as one of the people in the audience looking upon an industry that I honor and value so much, and seeing that right now we have two folks who have basically used that power to help themselves. And for somebody that's been in this business, from a teacher to a chief of staff in the United States Senate to the Department of Justice, that isn't what public service is about. That's not what public service was supposed to ever be about. And I couldn't help but jump in and say, we've got to change this, because the only way we're going to change it is by having political leaders who have always been dedicated to the real work of serving people.
But you know something about campaigns and just the amount of energy and effort that goes into something like this, especially in a place like California. You have to understand the mammoth task that must be ahead of you, just on an organizational standpoint. Are you not?
Absolutely. I mean, clearly I've seen it. In fact, not only did I see my own race, but over 2016, I saw about 50 different campaigns. And I'll tell you, politics has changed in this election cycle. Anyone who believes people are running the same kind of campaigns or that you need to run the same kind of campaigns and win has been asleep at the wheel if they haven't seen what's happened in Virginia and all across the country, where you see people speaking out, having a political engagement different than ever before. And that's really what we're going to lean into in this campaign. Let's be honest, I know this well. People really start tuning in January. And so I know now's the time to make sure that we're doing everything we can to meet people where they are. But we've got to use the new forms of communication, make sure that we are digital first and really talking to people where they are online. So it's certainly a mounting task. We know that. I've seen enough of it. But I also believe we're in a unique moment in time where people are tuning in and listening, and it starts now.
There are members of your own party who sort of had a raised eyebrow, or perhaps even more than that, to the announcement that you're entering this race. Sarah Reyes, former assemblywoman for Fresno, recently suggested on Twitter that your campaign is undercutting the Latino vote and the women's vote, and that this is some sort of a deal. How do you respond to that sort of criticism?
Yeah, I appreciate you asking me that question, because the idea that I would make a deal when everything else in my career has never been about that, you know, whether it was I was a school teacher in the Central Valley or going from that to Harvard Business School, I'm one of the very few that entered into the public service arena. And at the height of my policy career in D.C. as a chief of staff, most folks go into the lobby world, take that big paying job. I didn't. I actually came right back to the Central Valley and tried to inspire others. And right after the presidential campaign, again, a moment where a lot of political electeds or political leaders jump into the private sector to make a lot of money. I didn't. I went right into the Department of Justice to be on the front lines. So the notion that I would do anything to either undercut my passion for public service or a community I feel so strongly about, obviously as the daughter of farm workers, and my dad is from Mexico, Zacatecano, the notion that I would ever sell out is disturbing, and I think the truth is it really validates the unfortunate cynicism that exists within our political arena, and it really gets to the heart at exactly why we need people who run for the right reasons. And so, you know, it's unfortunate, but I believe so strongly in the passion of making sure that we have good public servants that I think as we talk to more folks, they'll understand that. And as they get to know me, they'll understand that across the state as well.
We only have a little bit of time, but I want to ask you about a few policy issues here, since this is really what the race is all about. Governor Brown has been all in on the high-speed rail project. Recently, news came out that the Central Valley stretch of that line is $3 billion over budget, and there's real concern as to whether the state will have enough money to finish the initial stretch at this rate. If you were in the governor's seat in Sacramento, would it still be full speed ahead or more of a cautious note from a Renteria administration?
So I think we've obviously have to look at the numbers. My career has been in the finance side of it and budgeting, et cetera. At the same time, I recognize that, you know, my two nieces recently graduated from high school, and the ability for them to have access to other parts of our state is also incredibly important, whether that's access to the jobs or experiences of being able to go up north or down south, and really connecting our state. I believe we do have to do that. I think to cut off Central Valley kids and opportunity both ways, whether people coming into the Central Valley or Central Valley folks being able to get out of the Central Valley, that connection is incredibly important to one California. And so I think we need to have the hard discussion about how do we do it and how do we do it efficiently. So I look forward to that discussion as governor with the unique perspective of understanding what it means for the Central Valley and our kids and opportunities going forward.
One last question. There's the Twin Tunnels project, which may at some point get whittled down to one tunnel. There's talk that the giant Metropolitan Water District in Southern California might essentially take over that project. Would that be something you support? Where do you fall on the Twin Tunnels?
Right. So I think we've got to take California water in a much broader perspective. I actually said a lot of this when I ran for Congress in the Central Valley, that the idea that we're going to have one answer to solve all of this is really not understanding water policy very well. And so when I ran, I said you had to have a number of different policies, including thinking about the tunnels, thinking about desalinization plants, thinking about what other kind of new efficiency models we have to take a look at. And the idea that we really haven't taken a comprehensive approach in terms of bringing the stakeholders to talk about what are the different ways we can do that is really a misstep in all of this. And so partly this is exactly why having a voice from the Central Valley is incredibly important. I think in the Central Valley, we've always understood that there is no single answer to this. And unless we actually take a much more comprehensive approach that does have stakeholder views from the South, from the North, and from the Central Valley, we'll never actually have a true answer to our water policy here in this state.
Amanda Renteria is the newest candidate for California governor. She hails originally from Woodlake. She ran for Congress in 2014 against David Valadao and most recently was the national political director for the Clinton campaign and then eventually went on to the Attorney General's office in California in between. Amanda just announced her candidacy and she joined us on Valley Public Radio. Amanda, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And stay with us here on Valley Edition. We'll be back in just a moment and learn about the invasive swamp rodent that's causing big headaches up in the Merced area and could have even bigger problems for water users, the environment, and more. That's all coming up here on Valley Edition.
You
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. As if the state didn't have enough water problems, there's a new one. It's not drought. It's not a declining Delta ecosystem. Those, of course, real problems. But this one could cause its own water issues throughout Central California. Instead, this is a creature described as an invasive swamp rodent, and it could do big damage to both the Delta ecosystem and the network of canals and levees that secure much of the state's water supply. Joining us now is Sacramento Bee reporter Ryan Sabalo to tell us more. Ryan, welcome.
Hi.
We're talking about this creature called the nutria. What is this swamp rodent, and why is it a big concern?
So these are rodents native to South America that were originally brought to the North America of last century for the fur trade. And they're a little bit bigger than a muskrat and not quite as big as a beaver. But think of them about this as about the size of a beagle. So anywhere, they just got one down in Merced County that was 22 pounds. They have a long orange teeth. And they like to, they're vegetarians, and they like to chew through aquatic vegetation. And they also have a nasty habit of burrowing through levees to make burrows. So you have a double threat here of, you know, California's lost about 90% of its wetlands. And you have this interconnected network of levees and canals. And wetlands all through the Central Valley. So you have a destructive presence that could harm both the ecosystem and the levee network, which also includes, which operates for both flood protection and for water supply.
Do we have an idea of how big the problem with the nutria is right now?
We don't. They found the first nutria last spring, and they've been trying to get a sense of where they are. They have no idea how they got here. They found the first one in Merced County, in around the town of Gustine, where there's a number of private and public wetlands down there. And they're basically, at this point, the state has one biologist down there trying to trap them in a little tiny corner of private wetland. And at this point, they're basically asking the public to tell them where they are as they try to scramble to come up with a battle plan against these things and to, you know, try to secure funding to set up a more robust trapping operation.
I understand it's sort of a race against time. Is that just due to the fact that these creatures have quite an aggressive reproduction cycle? What's the timeline like here?
Yeah, I mean, so nutria are amazingly prolific. They worry that within 5 years there could be upwards of 250,000 of these things fanning out through the waterways of California. And the deal is, these animals they're born to breed in aquatic habitats, and they are very fast at it. A female can have litters of up to a dozen or more, and she can become pregnant within 48 hours of giving birth. And their dispersal habitats are also troubling, because they can, the juveniles quickly disperse from their parents, and on their way up they can travel 50 miles or more looking for new habitats. And yeah, they're just they're bred they've evolved to be very effective breeders. Like, for instance, the females, they're milking apparatus is like right along their spine, so they can actually nurse in the water while while the juveniles come up and suckle. And so you just imagine how quickly they could get in and disperse when there's not a whole lot of you know, natural predators or habitats to kind of keep them confined.
So you mentioned that there's one person who's in charge of sort of the response right now in the Merced area and the Delta area, that where we're starting to see these creatures. What is the overall scope of the response otherwise? Are there other people going out hunting these creatures or trying to trap them?
At this point, from the state's perspective, no. I mean, from the state agencies, the state has only got the budget to send this one biologist out there. It's not even his full-time job. There are the counties, I'm sure, are probably paying attention. Local landowners are probably paying attention and trying to figure out if these things are there and probably getting trappers out. But, I mean, in terms of a coordinated statewide trapping effort, there's really nothing at that scale. And one of the things you got to kind of realize is why it's critical that the state needs to get on board on this is in places like Louisiana where these things have taken hold, it's a really expensive prospect to get rid of them. Louisiana is at the point where they've kind of thrown their hands up on extermination and more of, you know, they have a bounty program where they pay trappers X amount of dollars per nutria tail they bring in, and they kill, you know, enough of them where they'll pay out, you know, close to $1 million each year, and the problem hasn't even gone away. They have been able to eradicate them out of the Chesapeake Bay where they had an established population, but it cost millions of dollars, and, you know, it's just a nightmare once these things get in there.
And I understand there's some controversy over the governmental agency at the federal government level that has most effectively responded to prior nutria outbreaks, Wildlife Services. What's the story there?
Yeah, so my paper actually did a multi-part series a couple years ago where we took a look at, I wasn't involved in it, it was another reporter, but we looked at this agency has a, it's basically the extermination, it's called Wildlife Services, it's the extermination wing of the USDA, U.S. Department of Agriculture. And the agency is very good at killing what ranchers and others might deem a nuisance animal, such as a coyote. They've been very effective at it over the years, killing, you know, lots and lots of nuisance animals around airports and farm fields. And the environmental community and the animal protection organizations are not exactly big fans of this organization. And they hold a lot of sway in California wildlife management. And so the state is kind of reluctant to employ them or at least talk publicly about doing it. And but the reason why nutria was eradicated from the Chesapeake Bay, or at least it appears to have been, it's been 2 years since they've seen a sighting of those, was because of this agency they brought in. And so the state has to kind of manage its approach to this, knowing that this agency is not particularly popular in California. The other issue, there's another controversy kind of at play here, too. California voters, I believe it was back in the 90s, banned the use of certain trapping methods. Yeah, it was in 1998 under Proposition 4, and because those trapping methods were inhumane. They included things like neck snares and foot gripping and body gripping traps. These are the most effective traps you can use, but they're also, you know, controversial. And so the state, even the biologist and the federal government have to abide by this law in California. So they have to use traps that may be less effective than some of the other ones that are available elsewhere in the country.
So given the potential damage to native species, the Delta ecosystem, and California's water infrastructure and the multi-billion dollar agriculture community and also water supplies for cities, is it surprising that we don't see more action on this issue, or are we starting to see people from different sides take notice of this? What have you heard?
I think you're going to, I mean, they've kind of done a information campaign at the state to try to get the word out about this. And there's a bill in the legislature that is being discussed right now that would maybe send some money toward, it takes some greenhouse gas reduction fund money and sends $10 million of it into an invasive species program, which I would imagine would be used for nutria eradication. And so I think you're going to start to see some action on this. The question is whether they can get their get a plan and actions together to move fast enough, because they really are in a species as prolific as these nutria, racing against time.
Again, it's called an invasive swamp rodent. You can read all about the nutria and the potential damage it could do to the San Joaquin Valley's ecosystem and also the water supply system here in this part of the state in the Sacramento Bee. We've been talking with reporter Ryan Sabalo from the Bee, who has done extensive coverage on this. Ryan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Despite Proposition 64's passage, marijuana dispensaries are not legal in unincorporated Kern County and in the city of Bakersfield. But just because that's the case doesn't mean there's no controversy. In fact, the controversy has grown in recent weeks as dramatic claims of bribes, conspiracy, and more have rocked the headlines in Kern County. Here to tell us more is James Berger of the Bakersfield Californian, who has been doing a great job following this case. James, welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
So I want to bring in the story here, kind of where this first emerged in the public consciousness, and Supervisor Mike Maggard made some comments on another radio station, on Kern Radio, earlier this year. What exactly did he claim against a member of the Board of Supervisors, fellow member, and also others in the community?
Sure. So his it was kind of a surprising thing. He went on public a couple of radio shows on KARN and claimed that folks in the medical marijuana community, and including his fellow supervisor, Leticia Perez, and her husband, Fernando Jara, were conspiring to run candidates against him. Maggard has been a kind of a lightning rod figure for the medical marijuana community, has always been a fairly critical of dispensaries. And he voted against it last October when the board banned cannabis in unincorporated areas. And so he made that accusation against his fellow supervisor and her husband. And so he said that they're running a candidate against him, that he is they're bankrolling it with marijuana money, and that they are crossing the line for her as a conflict of interest, but that they're taking money to run things against him and to run a candidate against him, and that is a conflict of interest for her, who voted on marijuana in October as well. So those are the basic charges he put out there.
Now, certainly the Board of Supervisors, being a political body, is no stranger to allegations of politics. But does this go beyond the norm in terms of the relationship between two sitting supervisors?
It does. Generally, here in Kern County, these kinds of accusations don't rise to the public forum maybe as often as they do in other jurisdictions. It's kind of uncommon to have a sitting supervisor make such claims against another sitting supervisor. And the conflict of interest claim, which is the more serious of them, obviously she wants to back somebody against him. She's perfectly capable of doing that. Endorsements happen all the time. But the fact that he believes she has a conflict of interest and violated campaign finance laws is a pretty serious charge.
So where does Supervisor Perez fall on this issue? You said Maggard has been against the dispensaries in the county. Where does she stand on this in her record on votes?
She was the only person to vote against a ban. She is, in general, been supportive of medical marijuana. Her husband is a medical marijuana patient himself for PTSD. And so she was, in fact, very passionately frustrated by the direction the rest of the board took on this issue.
And how has she responded to the allegations from Maggard's camp?
She's rejected them out of hand. She said that while the candidate running against Mr. Maggard, Jeff Hindley, a City of Bakersfield firefighter, is a friend of hers, she's not backing his campaign. She's not supporting his campaign financially or as an advisory capacity. But she's also said that prior to the vote in October on medical marijuana, she and her husband took his political activity to the county council, Mark Nations, and got clearance for her to vote, and that she did not have a conflict of interest. The conflict accusation centers around the fact that her husband is a political consultant and has done some work in early 2017 for medical marijuana interests, statewide interests. And so that's really the core of the debate back and forth. She denies it. Supervisor Magger very strongly continues his claim that she stepped over the line.
So Magger, though, isn't the only person making serious claims of impropriety here. There's also David Abbasi, and he is making his own claims about individuals with the county here in this situation. Who is he, and what is he alleging?
So David Abbasi is a medical marijuana shop owner in the city of Bakersfield, and then has claimed operation of some shops in the county of Kern as well. And all of his shops have been closed down. He has a personal relationship with Jara and Perez. They were friendly, and in fact, Fernando Jara credits Abbasi with helping him understand how to use medical marijuana to treat his PTSD symptoms. And so Abbasi has come into this situation with very dramatic claims that political consultants representing a couple of other medical marijuana interests in the county have been using money to bribe Magard to get special consideration for their shops over his shops in a sort of battle over who gets to have operating shops in the county of Kern. While the county has a ban, there are currently 28 shops which are grandfathered under a previous court case and allowed to operate it through November of this year. And his shop is not one of those that is allowed to operate for the next few months. And so he's very unhappy about that and feels that the powers that be, Mr. Magner included, and a couple of influential political consultants here are trying to run him out of business while at the same time protecting their clients' ability to continue to operate.
Now, where is Magard on that policy issue? He has talked about changing county policy in some way to allow some medical dispensaries for certain parts of the county. What's the status of that, and what is his vision there?
Magard, following the ban, suggested an idea that there'll be some sort of delivery-only dispensary system for medical marijuana patients. That issue has been brought to, sent to a subcommittee of the Board of Supervisors, on which he sits and another supervisor, McGleason, sits. And that committee has yet to meet on the issue, and the full scope of medical marijuana services to the community are being considered, from what I understand. So that's still pending. And so we will have to wait to see about that. But Magard is definitely involved in a further discussion of how medical marijuana would work, at least in the county of Kern.
So going back to these new claims leveled by David Abbasi, is there any credibility there? He has said he has all sorts of evidence. Have we seen anything substantive from him, or is he just a political gadfly at this point?
He's made certainly a lot of claims that he has video or audio, text, or other information that proves his claims, proves that there have been bribes. He has been unwilling repeatedly to provide that information and proof to us, and he says he wants to use it for a court case against the county and the city. And so we are left with kind of what the county council has called this, which is that it's it's fabricated claims that are designed to roil this situation and an attempt to get Mr. Abbasi something. He isn't, in fact, is Supervisor Perez and another medical marijuana advocate from Riverside County has been active in Kern County, have both claimed that Abbasi is using those claims to try to extort them into getting his dispensaries back online, getting David Abbasi's dispensaries back online. We've seen texts to both Perez and to Eilenberg out of Riverside, where Abbasi demands that they make concessions for him, or he will embarrass them with information that he has.
So where does this leave the county with regards to its policy on cannabis? You mentioned the dispensaries that are grandfathered into operation right now through November, and this goes all the way back. We had the Measure G fight years ago over medical dispensaries. With all of the turmoil here, what's next?
Well, really, what next is we will hear what the committee of two supervisors has to say about it, what proposal they have to maintain medical marijuana access in Kern County is, and then we'll see what the full board does, and politically what the larger the debate over legalization under Prop 64 was extremely heated in Kern County. We had very active church and conservative groups who did not want any sort of permitted use or business operation in the county, and you had very strong advocacy from the medical marijuana community that they have to have some way to legally acquire what they see as medicine here. So it's going to be a hot issue. Had these accusations and claims and these kind of almost salacious exchanges that have gone on are sure to complicate that and make, I guess, civil discourse a little more difficult to reach, perhaps.
And in an election year, it should be very interesting for political observers. Again, joining us today, James Berger with the Bakersfield Californian. You can continue to read his fine coverage in that paper and online at bakersfield.com of the dueling accusations about impropriety among members of the Board of Supervisors and people in the cannabis industry and their relations to those individuals. You can read that again in the Californian. James Berger, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Happy to be of assistance.
Ranchers in California don't always agree with environmentalists on how to fight climate change. Capital Public Radio's Ezra David Romero reports on a partnership between a popular outdoor brand and a Northern California ranching family that's both green, friendly, and profitable.
Lonnie Estelle's family ranches on thousands of acres in Modoc County on the border of Nevada and California. We're in a field surrounded by sheep looking out on a place called Surprise Valley.
Right now they're just eating and living life, just happy.
It's a beautiful, almost forgotten place where the West still lives. That's the county's motto. Very few industries besides agriculture exist here.
There's a lot that goes into this. It's really hard to run a business this size.
That struggle got a little easier around 4 years ago when she got a call from a woman named Rebecca Burgess with a regional textile group called Fibershed. Burgess asked her to ranch in a way that would benefit the environment, but that would also preserve her lifestyle.
To be able to do that, they needed an economy to be stable enough to retain their way of life.
It took a bit of arm twisting for the family to get on board because of previous encounters with environmentalists.
Ranchers have been threatened constantly by the environmental community, so we had to kind of open up our minds a little bit to accept what was being offered as a genuine offer.
They finally accepted. This meant they could establish an environmentally friendly farm plan with grant money. It was a new thing because very few people ranch in a sustainable way in Modoc County. Lonnie even says she gets questions from ranchers who don't believe in climate change. She responds by saying,
"So you don't believe in global warming and climate change? Okay. What about your riparian zones? What about your soil that is now full of worms and producing more grass than it did before?"
But her Operation Bear Ranch couldn't become an environmentally friendly farm on its own. With Fibershed's help, the family created a carbon farm plan.
Climate-friendly farming, I would say, is just being aware of the soil.
Lonnie's talking about farm practices that take carbon out of the air and suck it into the ground. Too much carbon in the air is a bad thing, but in soil, it's a plus. Today, the family has help in the form of grants from the Natural Resources Conservation Service. And there are now 5 carbon farming practices in play on the ranch. Perhaps the most visible is composting.
Got my shovel. That's pretty good stuff. Still got some wood chips, but the manure's all decomposed down.
Now her ranch takes the equivalent of 850 cars worth of carbon dioxide out of the air and into the ground. The popular outdoor brand, the North Face, got wind of this and offered to further help the ranch with grants. The end result? A climate-friendly beanie using wool from the ranch.
It's unbelievably soft. It's unbelievably warm.
James Rogers is director of sustainability for the company. He says this year the brand is expanding the line to a scarf and jacket using Lonnie's wool.
You're trying to reduce the negative impact of a product. And that's what got us so excited about this initiative.
We're at Warner Mountain Weavers in the town of Cedarville. That sound is a woman weaving a rug. This is where Lonnie and her friends sell great products.
To our right, you'll see the Lonnie's Lana Corner.
For Lonnie, this partnership that all started with a cold call has given her a second chance at life. The volume of wool the North Face buys allows her to get into larger mills at wholesale rates. She hopes the partnership opens the door for other ranchers in Mogot County.
I definitely feel blessed. It's taking what's in your storehouse and making that a plus. I think that this area has the potential to be a small manufacturing area because the cost of living is less.
She's already developed a second line called community-supported cloth sold in 3 stores. She wants to get that number up to 9. I'm Ezra David Romero.
And that's all for today's Valley Edition. As always, we'd like to know what you think. Send us your comments about the show. talk@kvpr.org is our email address, and if you're on Twitter, we are too. You can find us at KVPR and at Valley Edition. Also, search Valley Public Radio on Facebook and Instagram and find us there. You can listen to the station on your smart speaker, on your mobile device with our new KVPR app, and of course on the KVPR website as well at kvpr.org. And you can subscribe to our podcast there. Check out Valley Edition's podcast and get this program delivered to your device every week when it's brand new. For Valley Edition's reporting crew of Christina Lopez, Laura Tsutsui, and Carrie Klein, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This has been Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, honoring the Community Water Center's leaders as recipients of the 2018 James Irvine Foundation's Leadership Awards, on the web at irvine.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need, on the web at chcf.org. And the California Endowment, health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org.